We're going to look quickly at the impacts of these on each stakeholder, and then we're going to roll the dice and do our probabilities. And then we're going to put this in a broader context around scenario planning, and then we're going to have a conversation around what actions could you take regardless of the scenario, what things could you do, and then we're going to end. All right, so we're going to try to get you out of here before noon, but we really want to cover all these things that we got left, right? We want to take all this and turn it into something specific. So let's go to... We probably don't want to do all four stakeholders on all four scenarios, right? Because if we were actually doing this scenario planning exercise for your organization, you would need to, right? You need to understand the impact of these scenarios on your consumers and on your provider base and on other payers in your region and on employers, right? Because you're using it. Here we're just using this as an example, so we're not going to take our way through that. We're probably going to do one or two stakeholders for each scenario and then move on to the next thing. Just so Cheryl's going to take us through that.
So by a show of hands, we have to choose two of these stakeholders. So I was sitting here during the break thinking about which two should we choose. So I'm going to be very democratic. Oh. How many would you like to do the impact to payers? Okay, how about providers? Okay, employers? Yeah. Consumers?
No one likes employers.
Okay, I think it's certainly payers, and then it's between providers and consumers. Let's see it. Providers or consumers? Providers? Consumers. Okay, all right, we're gonna do payers and consumers.
Oh, I'm
prescribed lady. Yeah, yes, that's right. Right.
Do it by, yeah.
Okay. Scenario one, nothing really, not a lot happens. We kind of continue on with what we've got. So the impact of things not changing right now is, what do you think the impact is? If things sort of stay status quo, what do you think the impact is? Now, I think the real interesting thing here is that, back to that slide that showed certain uncertainty, how we gauge the amount of uncertainty, I was thinking on the plane on the way down here that it's just like, what? And we've been doing these scenario planning things, and so my perception of uncertainty has gone way up from what it was a year ago or 6 months ago or 3 months ago. And so I have to kind of level set myself and say, am I overreacting to the uncertainty? And therefore that causes certain things, as Nance said, or is it truly, truly that uncertain? So if we take scenario one, where things don't change a lot, What is the impact of that to our operations as payers today?
So I think the thing that has a really high likelihood of happening is that the mandate, the value of the mandate gets diminished. I think there's broad Republican support of that. There's already some signaling from the IRS that they're not going to pay attention to it. So payers have to immediately consider what's the impact of that in their underwriting.
Right. So the value of the mandate's diminished.
So let's talk about the impact. That means people could impact prices go up potentially, or payers decide whether or not to participate in the marketplace. Is that
right? Exactly. I mean, you have to think through what are your potential choices. So one, you have to understand your market and how many of folks could potentially decide to pull out as a result of it's not necessarily a change in the law,
right?
But it's a change in the enforcement of the law, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're gonna have to make some assumptions around how many of those folks, knowing that there's not gonna be enforcement, are going to decide to go uninsured, and what's the likely profile of those folks? Are they likely gonna be less sick or more sick? Certainly they're gonna likely be less sick. What's that? What's that impact to your underwriting? And
what's the impact then to other payers in your marketplace that may be leaving the market?
Right.
Right.
That's why I said
right?
More payers exiting.
Does it impact the rest of your business? You know, we kind of shrugged about the employers, but does it, how does things staying the same as they are and perhaps an erosion of that individual market because of the relaxation in the individual market, how does that impact the rest of your business as a payer? Does it impact your employers?
Well, I think if you think of us as provider-sponsored plans, it impacts our systems in terms of the cost shift and the increase in emergency department or uncompensated care, which creates a cost shift and an additional pressure upon us to perform or help or change or whatever.
Any other specifics around that as you see the... We were talking at the break a little bit about free clinics and the impact that, that the ACA has had on those free clinics or those charitable clinics and that kind of thing.
Well, Cheryl, I was thinking more about the possibility that states could combine individual and small group pools as they have in some places. That could be more widespread.
So the combination of small group and individual pools.
This goes back to previous. I actually think you end up with more carriers entering the market, but they're a different kind of carrier. You end up with Medicaid plans entering the market if the market's stabilized and you know that CSR is going to continue. If CSR continues, that's kind of the magic in all this stuff. Medicaid plans enter the market and they can manage this population well. So that's one thing. The other big change is going to be you're going to spend a lot more on, you see people spending their actual money, like their hard dollars, on marketing budgets because especially if you're a Medicaid plan, you want people to participate. You know the federal government's not going to – they cut the marketing budget as soon as they walked in the door. So you need to have a marketing budget if you're going to plan to stay in this and actually, you know, push people on to your product.
Right. Back to the comments that were made a little earlier, I think it was Marianne that said, you know, we take what we learn and we got smarter. We certainly have learned a lot about marketing and individuals where 7 to 8 years ago we didn't – most of us didn't have very much – work good in that area.
In this case, at least for us, it becomes more of a financial decision. There's not as much variability now that we have to consider in the financial decision. So have we been making money up to this point, and if not, why? And this is going to continue on what we're saying for some time, the same circumstances. And so if things are not going to significantly change, if we assume the status quo, then we're making a product line decision based on financials, not based on some, you know, wild opportunity that's faced in the future.
Exactly. Yeah. So that we maybe hone our skills even better, and again, as you put it before the break, kind of informed by the latest chaos.
Can you narrow your
Mm-hmm. Okay, nothing changes. What happens to the consumers? What are you hearing from individuals?
Their products get more terrible. I mean, I don't know what, like, they get a Medicaid product that the federal government's paying a whole lot for. They may not pay anything, but they're going to get a Medicaid-like product with a super narrow network.
As time goes on, you know, you see more people pick it up. We actually saw a huge uptake this last open enrollment because they thought it was going to go away.
That's a real good point.
So I think that you probably see more people going into the exchange, mm-hmm. potentially.
Becoming more comfortable on electronic, on the internet and that kind of thing, do you think? What about how
California
how will,
is a different
how will they,
animal.
Will they still be accessing brokers, do you think?
No.
I think that's market dependent. Our CEOs and CFO have been really concerned that we have so much broker use in our market, but that's just indicative of our market. I don't know that everybody is that way. As long as there's brokers out there providing value, people will probably go to them before they'll go to the internet, as long as it costs them the same.
So I have a comment back on the Medicaid-like products and fewer choices. That, again, is state-dependent, right? If they were to get Medicaid in New Mexico, pretty much everything is covered. So, you know, I do think we were one of those bright green states on that map where, with the highest expense in Medicaid, and I think that's going to be variable by state.
That's in my mind what Medicaid looks like.
Option, but if we get a Medicaid-like for all, right, then depending on the state.
Well, I think when you were talking about that, though, you were saying sort of products with safety net as your only provider choice. Is that what you meant? So versus a traditional. Well, and that also varies by state, because some states have the same provider network regardless of coverage choice, and other states, like in California, in many regions, it's a completely different network, right?
So various states.
What about consumers who are enrolled through small groups, that kind of thing? Because some of those choices have changed over the last few years. Do you see that still changing? Do you see them being impacted by change in the rules? What about small group, people who are enrolled through small employers? You know, do you see the impact of what's happening now impacting them?
Well, I think, like in Missouri, we had guarantee issue for small groups, so there's a lot of rules surrounding that market even before the ACA. But, you know, we also see that because of the community rating, if that stays, that their brokers are pushing, you know, self-funding down to like 10 employee groups, some odd things. I think as long as it's community rated, you'll see moves to self-funding small groups. If that goes away, I think, again, our state governed small groups. I think a lot of states did, and there were rating restrictions and things. And so that market was pretty stable, I think, to begin with. So less instability than the individual market, I would say.
I think in this one, you might be talking about the Cures Act.
Yeah,
the
I'm talking about, yeah.
Small groups to put in almost like a defined contribution model, so that could increase the size of the individual market.
Right. I realize that I was kind of, but I'm thinking in terms of the consumer and the individual as a consumer, and some of them may be changing into that individual mindset, if you will.
You know, one thing we didn't discuss earlier, but I think it has an impact on particularly consumers, is the level of noise that remains in the media and in the market about dissatisfaction about this. I think if it stays status quo, I believe politically that the people that are in opposition of current Obamacare are going to continue to keep the accelerator down on trying to make people feel uncomfortable with what they have. If we went to something else, then I think people would calm down a little bit more. There wouldn't be as much agitation in the market. So I think as long as people are being slowly prodded and needled to be unhappy with what they have, there's going to still be this unrest among people thinking there's something better that we're just holding back on them.
To Tom's point, I think the sands have shifted on that, and I think what we've seen out of the interim rules so far, and what they could do, for instance, with risk adjustment and shifting maybe even to a Medicare type approach, the 1332 waivers is a good example. I've got to think that there may be an easing of the fears that are being propagated, but maybe that's just because I'm optimistic.
Anything else around consumers? How they access care? We've talked about narrow networks. Anything else about how consumers might access care going forward? Are we seeing that shift? They're just confused.
I think that people who lost their insurance because of the lack of that mandate are not, the people who lose insurance because of lack of the mandate are not going to keep up with their health care, and they're going to end up re-entering the market sick, like the, just like when people first entered the market with Obamacare. Mm-hmm. They had more severe illness than if they had been getting taken care of all along.
All right. So, you said we were going to talk payers and consumers. How about scenario two, which is the big idea, right?
Yeah. This is like everyone gets covered. And
so what's the impact? Depends on the idea, right? So of all the kinds of big ideas that we talked about, single payers, I'm going to flip it over for a minute. Let's remind us. Am I the only one?
Get some kind of universal coverage, and it's an enhanced form of the ACA with delivery side reform. So lots of potential inputs that are significantly improve access to coverage, cost of coverage, and as a result of improvement.
So the impact of that happening?
On payers.
Yeah, on payers. Are you ready? How's it going to impact you? This is really at home. You're the ones.
Start selling supplemental products. And
new product opportunities, is that what
you mean?
That's
one way.
That's one way. So it depends on how they do it.
It depends on if, you know, the option at the bottom of the page, which is, you know, flat fee schedule, so you don't have to have contract negotiation. That equals more payers entering the market, more competition, and there's just more of everything. Whereas if you, you know, if you cut us out, obviously, I'd cut like more than half my staff. I mean, because our, you know, the individual market will completely go away. It'll go to some sort of managed Medicaid bid or something like that.
Impact will be because it largely depends on if the big idea is good or if the big idea is bad, right? So, right. I mean, there's so many variables around. We can say what we would like the big idea to be, but you'd almost have to do two scenarios if the big idea is horrible or if the big idea is good. So I'm not sure.
So let's for this point, let's just assume, and maybe just kind of do it quickly for payers, that there's new product opportunities, there's changing competitive mix, and that there's more people covered, right? So there's some kind of dynamism. There's something to that, you know, we know that the uninsured will probably shrink in this scenario, right? And that there would be, whether it's more entering into an MCO-like product or a much more expanded individual or whatever, we don't know what that looks like, but there's probably a bigger market than we have now, right?
In one sense, it could be that we're right now administering lots of different products, lots of different benefit designs and that kind of thing, and it could be that then it makes it more simple. There's one or two or whatever, and that would impact our operations.
Maybe the big thing to take away on this one is it might turn our business models upside down. We might need to really revisit our business models.
Exactly.
You could bet if something like this happened, then you would see a whole bunch of new ideas funded through VCs trying to make money on this transformation, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You would see big new entrants and big disruption, because there would be like this big set of money, or the perception of it, right? So turn business models upside down and change the competitive dynamic.
How will it impact your relationships with providers? I mean, let's think for a minute about, you know, we can talk about the operations, the paying the claims, the member services, the administration of the benefits, everything like that. On the other side, we have all of our relationship with providers, your provider owned. And so if there's some big idea that hits real hard, how does that impact you in those relationships?
Well, whatever the
Oh, thanks. I don't know if this is important to have a microphone, but let's imagine that, you know, one of the big carriers, national carriers, got the contract as they consolidated that. Then clearly they would leverage that opportunity to affect the other markets with the delivery system. Mm-hmm. It would create a tremendous amount of leverage to say, okay, I'll add you to my network for the individual market, but I want this rate for the employer market.
So the disruptive provider contracts in general, whether it's more bargaining power on rates or trying to do something different with it, or
it would shift a lot of the power away from the delivery system to whoever gets to play in the sort of faux single payer model.
Sure. Okay, big idea. We blast them with something they've never heard of. or the thoughts that we had in terms of a single payer. And I suppose that the impact to the consumer and the way the consumer perceives that is going to vary from market to market. Kind of from where they are today to how big of a change it is. Right? So if we think about consumers, our individual members that came into us through the exchange, now it's a whole new thing?
So I just would say a new wave of confusion and new opportunities for education and marketing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. New wave of confusion and new opportunities for marketing and education. Wave of confusion.
The funding mechanism is going to be important. Will it increase taxes? Will it increase deficits? I'm good. So, the impact on consumers could be higher tax rates.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it could be that they have to go through a whole different method of accessing their benefits. Again, the confusion. What else? Okay. Payers on scenario three. And scenario three, let's review it real quick.
This is AHCA. So this is basically the variation of the bill we have in play. Subsidies are age versus income. Reduce Medicaid over time. Continuous coverage as an incentive, which will serve.
That goes through, and I think as we looked at what was being bandied about, what has it been 2 weeks now ago, and we looked at the impact to payers, what kind of impacts were there to you from that?
Many of you probably did some scenario planning.
Yeah, I was just thinking.
Quarterly changes and having to keep up with that, increased administrative expenses because you've got teams of people working on nothing but this, trying to keep it all straight, and uncertain margins because you're constantly looking at shifting pools of patients. Plus, there's just instability.
A certain amount of confusion in the Medicaid market, right? If some of those subsidies, if they changed it to a block grant, how the Medicaid programs might change and how that then would impact even non-Medicaid payers, right?
This operational issue is a big one because basically we're shifting from an income-based to an age-based subsidy, but with a cap on who can get it, so you need now double. You need income and age, and you need to figure out, so there's a new game in town for figuring that out operationally.
And I'm generally an optimist, cautiously, but I think the other piece of this, though, is that uncertainty creates great opportunity for the regional plans like all of us represented here. It disrupts the bigger players more than it disrupts us, and if we can position ourselves well, what we saw in the last 8 years is we've picked up higher percentages of certain markets than we've traditionally been able to.
Yay, goodness.
So you know, there's opportunity now. Yeah, now we're starting to make money on that. That's a different part of the thing. So, you know, the first couple of years was tenuous.
Has that been true in all your markets?
Half, at least half of the population in an individual market, and so it would tighten the market greatly. The loss ratios would go up, so pricing would have to go up. It would be certainly a death spiral in Maine, just given our population.
We'll lose a lot of Medicaid patients also, and I think people with lower income are going to be more uninsured, and we'll lose that population.
And so, and the impact to the payer with the uninsured going up is that it hits us in rates for the most part, right? Especially provider-owned plans. So, how does it impact consumers?
Nostalgia.
Yep.
Young and rich. Yeah. It's always been great to be young and rich.
Some things never change.
It really hurts low-income people.
Federal.
Yeah, especially
federal.
But anybody who's low-income really suffers from that. And people who are middle-income do better.
I think it underscores what Marianne was talking about, people being dissatisfied, the dissatisfaction within the greater population about how this is being handled, because people would be losing friends and neighbors and that kind of thing, begin losing coverage or having to pay higher rates or whatever, can also continue to stir that level of dissatisfaction that all must be wrong. I think it also creates opportunity, somewhat in a negative sense, for some kind of charlatans. I mean, to sell people low-cost plans that don't have any benefits in them, that kind of thing, it creates a market for that, and with that confusion and concern. And so I think that as regional plans and where people identify with you because of the regional provider system, they can be looking to payers to help sort that all out. And that becomes a real touchy thing from a marketing sales perspective. How do you say those other plans aren't any good without just looking like you're being sour grapes and that kind of thing? So I think that creates a whole marketing and sales shift that we may not have had to do before. And it's back to we have to explain more, that kind of thing. Yeah.
I didn't mean for, you know what I mean?
Really?
But
yeah.
For products that are risky.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those things that because we're really paying attention to the knitting and we've got a lot going on, that could be happening out there, impacting, and we might not even see it.
Oh, I guarantee you there's people planning on that right now with this scenario.
I think it's worse products. We already have bad products.
Yeah. All right, and number four. Is the market breaks down? How does that impact payers?
This market includes unfunded subsidies. Many players exit, or the national players exit. Some sort of chaos, death spiral, deterioration of care and health status of the country, variables by state, and potential economic recession.
Payers. It's a pretty simple answer, right? For payers, you get out. You get out of the individual market. I mean, why would you stay in? You'd get out. I mean, the big ones already are. I think, even though we're not talking about it, number four, the biggest impact is going to be on providers. Mm-hmm. And you know, probably consumers, but on providers. They're going right back to where we started, where they have high levels of uncompensated care. It's just going back to the future, you know.
Right. Yeah. If they didn't have DISH, yeah. Yeah, so you have providers under stress in that environment. And so both from a payer as a consumer perspective, it's much more difficult for us to put programs in, to do any kind of new care management things when we're all just trying to survive and our provider systems are trying to figure out how to do it. And again, contracting and paying and the pressure back on a provider-owned plan to perform in that kind of financial stress becomes a bigger issue as well.
So that means that your rates in other lines of business would need to go up?
Yeah.
If you're talking about this one from the consumer standpoint, they may not have a choice or limited choice and what they can get, and then it probably is going to delay. They'll probably not seek treatment as early on in an illness, and perhaps either could be more threatening to what they have or push it off and create a higher cost. That does have an impact on not only the providers but on the individuals themselves. And there's a lot of bankruptcies that already take place, you know, based off of people not being able to pay their coverage. So
exactly.
If there's no coverage, that would increase it.
You know, and it really puts the payer and the provider on the hot seat, because you can imagine some of the horrible news stories. If somebody says, we couldn't afford, we were going to go bankrupt, we didn't take our sick child. When we got there, the ER was crowded. They only cared about whether or not we had insurance. And it hits the front pages of the paper. And then trying to maintain that, your relationship with those communities, both as a provider and a payer, becomes really complicated.
Not to be too positive on this, but one positive thing for us at least would be if we could return to underwriting small groups, our small group block would get profitable again. I mean, so the individual market, we would lay off more than half of our staff, but at the same time, I'd hire two underwriters and we'd start going after small group business with a vengeance.
Right.
I think the other markets would get more competitive, though, because if everyone exits the individual market, then it shrinks the market, right? And so for the big players to grow, they're going to go be more aggressive over a large group, small group.
And they're going to be actively underwriting those groups as well and competing out there.
That's an excellent point, because when you have contraction, you have more people going after the same members, right?
Right.
So that's the pressure on
all sides. Right. So anything else on the consumers?
We should not end with this one, because it leaves everyone feeling depressed. Let's go back to, like, rainbows and unicorns. All right, you guys ready to take
good.
Your...
Oh, yeah. I'm going to roll the deck.
For under consumers, I think, you know, with the people losing insurance and it also with Obamacare, people have gradually come to accept that it's a good thing for people to be covered. I think whether they like Obamacare or not, they it's become more acceptable to think that it's that health care is more of a right. So I think that it could lead to social unrest if there are a lot of people who are uninsured and suffering financial problems because of lack of insurance.
The uninsured lives matter.
They would be the one.
That's funny. Uninsured lives matter. That's the quote. Yeah. Well, so what we're going to do is now of these. Well, no, we're going to just vote across them. We did each one when we had each market.
Oh, okay.
So now of these four scenarios, let me just put them back up. Each of you has to make a claim. Which you think is going to happen? So are we headed in the next 5 years to scenario 1, 2, 3, or 4?
5 years.
5 years. So that means, what is it now? It's 2017. That means in 2022, which of these places will we be in?
You just want us to start shouting?
No. We're gonna actually take a... So everyone who... Oh. Is everyone's thinking... Everyone who thinks we're going to be in land one?
So, by the way, is number three refinement of the current exchange?
It's the A8. That's a typo by me here. Okay. It's AHCA. So this is the reappeal and replace.
As it was last week.
Yeah.
But I mean, well, essentially, it was a refinement. It was an attempt to refine what exists today.
I think that's what the Freedom Caucus would say, but that's not what others would say.
Could you just say number three would be some version of Trump care that was not a big idea.
Yeah. So
it would be like a Trump care that is a rearranged version of Obamacare. With some changes.
I mean, like the adjustments.
What they tried to do, and then they finally get some milked down version of it.
One means we're going to be in this land. I think we had two. We only had one? Oh, two. We have two.
Three.
We have three. Who thinks that number one is going to take place? We have four votes for number one.
Five.
Oh, wait. Wait. How many do we have on number one? People are changing their minds. One, two, three, four, five, six now on number one. Okay. So let's go to, we should have changed the order. Let's go to number three. This is, you guys think that the bill is going to go through and the Republican?
A bill. That amends the current system.
But, okay.
It's the time what we had, but that's number one.
But I thought that was.
No. This is.
They don't repeal it.
This is what's interesting is the AHCA doesn't actually technically repeal Obamacare, but we won't get to that. But, well, here's the difference. This is status quo with some regulatory changes. This shifts, this makes all those changes. This shifts the subsidy to based on age. This pulls back Medicaid expansion.
It shifts them in some way, but
yeah.
Right. It changes the current structure. Correct.
But the assumption is what was as of the 18, which is age-based subsidization, which eliminates the current status quo. So that's the difference between 1 and 3. Because we're only talking about the individual market.
Correct.
So that at least that's how I perceive it.
Well, I perceive one is just CMS and Tom Price tinkering around with the regulations, and three is there is some kind of bill passed that changes the status quo.
Right.
Yeah.
You're still 99.
So number one is nothing gets passed legislatively. It's just through administrative rules that things get fingered. Mm-hmm. Number three is something gets passed legislatively, right?
Yes.
So do we need to re-vote on number one?
Did that change anyone's vote?
No, I'm still in three.
Okay. So this would mean something like... I mean, I don't think it's just anything passes. I mean, this is basically saying something like the Ryan plan passes. Maybe a few tweaks from what we've seen, but something that's largely like the Ryan plan passes through Congress. Yeah. So this is what the number of people who think that's going to happen is a lot. Yeah.
10.
I still think that we wouldn't, those that voted for three aren't going to agree on what we think the changes are going to be. I'm just voting on that because it's not going to be the status quo. They're going to change some of the regulations.
Okay.
There's going to be a bill passed that somehow might changes the subsidies. It might change how Medicaid works. I don't think it's going to be close to what we almost got 2 weeks ago, but there's going to be changes.
Okay. So we have... So with some hesitation, we have a very... Okay.
Yeah.
Number two is the big idea, and we head... towards universal coverage through some disruptive model in the next 5 years. Anyone?
It's sad that no one's voting for that. But yeah.
Okay.
Only if the war happens.
Then you're on a 10-year high line, right?
Yeah.
All right. So number four is the market breaks down. Various triggers occur that sort of lead to chaos. This could...
already is.
Yeah. There's more than 16 people.
Who didn't vote? I'm surprised we don't have any votes.
Yeah.
know, how you define market breaking down is interesting, right? Because if you define market breakdown as large issuers,
there's 22 people.
The market's breaking down now.
Six people didn't vote. We just killed.
Right. Well, so issuers, we did in the first scenario say that there's fewer issuers on the exchanges. In this one, we said sort of everyone leaves, right? This is more of a catastrophic version. And we have heard members of Republican leadership say this could be an intentional strategy. Let's do everything we can to blow this up so people get so miserable that it'll force the Democrats to accept our plan, right? So we have had people in power say this is something that they intend to pursue. Whether or not they could achieve that, I think we have a bunch of people here that don't think that's possible, though. Yeah.
But this is over 5 years, right?
Yeah.
So if you change the question to over 10 years or over 20 years, we probably would raise our hands. But over 5 years, probably going to not change too dramatically.
Okay.
Anybody want to vote for
No? Yeah, all right. All right. All right, so we're going to see what the dice say about scenario one. Ready?
What does this mean? What does it mean?
It's like Dungeons and Dragons.
Four. The dice are giving...
The probability.
They're giving... The dice say four.
Okay.
Somebody else.
4 out of 12.
Give folks a chance to throw.
4 out of 12. What's the probability?
So now we're looking at number two, a big idea. Six.
Six.
Oh.
Wait. Don't look. We have to know what we're voting for. This one is number three, a major. Okay.
No, I didn't even see it. Sorry.
Was it? A...
What else could it be besides number three?
Obviously,
we voted on three after two. Right?
Okay. We have an 11. I believe intent matters. Okay.
I didn't see it.
Okay, we had 11. I didn't even see what it was.
Yeah, I
know. Okay. Okay, so now we're going to do number four. You want to vote, run a roll? Of course.
Oh, this is awesome. 12.
I have an alternative.
5.
Don't beat out number one.
The dice are.
It's your alternate reality.
Alternate
yes.
And you can't even have a one. So.
But it's relative, right?
Okay, so relativity.
That's the answer to everything in life, right? It's relative.
The phone dice speak.
The phone dice speak. Okay.
More precise than magic eagle.
So what we just did. And I will write this all up, and you guys will have a definition of each scenario and what people think. What we attempted to do was come up with four scenarios, and so we've kind of taken them on. It's almost like we tried on that outfit for a day to figure out what it would be like to live here. So as an organization, when you do this, you can say in each of these scenarios, what would it mean for our market? What would our competitors do? What would it do for our own mix of business and so on, and sort of try those on. But how does it fit into a broader strategic planning process? So when we think of strategic planning, we think of sustainable competitive advantage, right? That's a sort of a good old-fashioned, how do we do what we do better than others? Some health insurers haven't had to think about sustainable competitive advantage, or they haven't had as much threat to that because they've had some kind of market protections, right? But what we've seen here is some disruption that could change the current strategic environment. So when we try to achieve a sustainable competitive advantage, if you listen to Porter, now there's many models, I don't think Porter's the only one, but he's very common. He says there's a few things that an organization can do. There's only a few levers they can pull, and that is, or that could change their position in the market. They could have new competitors enter. They could have substitutes for products and services replace what they do. So we can see that happening in healthcare. A substitute is going without coverage. You know, a substitute is going to paying as you go urgent care, right? A substitute is personal relationships with direct primary care, right? We can see some of those substitutes that could disrupt the insurance model. Bargaining power of customers, what customers will or won't pay, right? And then bargaining power of suppliers. Well, this kind of relates quite a bit to what we would consider. So one thing that an organization can do when you try these on is consider these factors in each of the scenarios to say, how would each of these play out for us in our own business? What Porter says is that there's only any organization has one of three choices in that setting when they filter through all of these variables. You can either have the lowest cost, have differentiating products and services, or dominate a niche, right? And he says you can't ever do all of those. And some organizations try to do many at once, right? But that you have to become really good at doing one of these three things to create a sustainable competitive advantage. And what we do with the scenario planning process is we continually vet this. We test and change and revisit these models. So in that, these are two quotes from Porter. The first test of a strategy is whether your value proposition is different from your rivals. So you can say, as an organization, if we're in this scenario one, is our value proposition different than our competitors in a way that we can sustain a competitive advantage in this environment, right? And the second test is, do we support our value proposition with a set of activities that are well aligned to the proposition? So are we funding ourselves in this model in a way that allow us to continue? Are we putting our priorities in the right actions that will allow us to achieve that goal in that setting? So we can ask each of these two questions of our organization in each of these settings. So let's think about how this now applies. So if we were to take what we just did and say, what do we need to do differently, or what could we do regardless of the scenario? Is there anything that would fit in more than one scenario, or something that would fit in all of the scenarios, something that an organization would need to do to achieve a sustainable competitive advantage?
Yeah, so in the first scenario, you know, we've kind of gone through this exercise, and we looked at our, and I'm sure a lot of others have as well, we basically looked at the fact that in certain geographies, the adverse selection was creating a higher impact on our bottom line, and we chose in 2017 to pull out of certain markets, and now we're repositioning to get back in some of those, but not all of them, for 2018. Likewise, we also looked at increasing our pricing significantly last year in certain across the book of business for the individual markets, and realized that if our competitors didn't go at that same level, we had two. Well, it was going to change the option. If they met us or they were close, we could tweak the price in the second round and stay in. But if we were too far disparate, we were just going to have to pull out entirely, because we knew that would enter us into a death spiral where only our sickest patients would stay with us. So we've kind of used this scenario planning really with option one in mind, you know, pre-election, to do just that.
So what I'm going to do is take this excellent point and apply it across the scenarios where we say, if we know that no matter what happens, we're going to have to revisit our market participation and pricing, to get ready to make those decisions quickly, we can have a process in place where we know what the decision criteria would be and what factors we would use, how we would get the data to support those decision criteria. Because if we know we're going to have to do these two things, by what date, what time, and what's going to trigger us to make those decisions. And if you have those things in place, you're much better equipped to make these decisions when they arise, right? So that's different than saying we're going to wait and see what happens and then we'll do the analysis. If you know you're going to have to make these decisions, we can plan for that.
Yeah, we knew the spread that we were willing to live with or not. If it was
yes.
Above a certain spread, we were out entirely. If it was below that spread, we would tweak.
We need to continue working on integration with the delivery system and with quality and improving customer satisfaction.
So regardless of the scenario, there's not a scenario where you're hurt by increasing that integration. And you can see, especially in areas of chaos, where it might be even more important to have, right? So you had two different ideas there, the delivery system, but I don't want to lose the second idea.
Also, quality
okay.
and customer satisfaction. So we don't lose, if we could get customers to stay with us, even with the changes, that would be good. Or if they tell their friends.
So maybe... Well, this is where it's interesting. So if you look at this with the hat of actions, so the focus on quality, I think, I mean, I've heard some people say that a race to the bottom takes all the pressure off of quality because no one will care, which puts a lot of mission-driven organizations in a bind. This came up at a meeting, I'm not kidding. So focus on customer service is something you can say, regardless, we saw a lot of chaos in these scenarios, and in order to retain, and we also saw more competition for customers, right? So if customers are feeling fearful and they're seeing chaos, one way to kind of retain some of those rather than lose them to your competitors is have a tighter bond or create a source, be a source of trust around the confusion in the marketplace. I don't know, many organizations probably have already trained their customer service on how to handle with people calling and saying, what does all this mean for me, right? What about HSAs? We haven't talked about them much today, but they're a huge part of the Republican platform. I talked to some organizations that have decided that regardless of what happens, HSAs are going to be more important, and they're going to increase their integration with the banking solution and really sort of double down on their HSA investments, both for Medicaid and individual.
Two things. One, can you expand the use of them beyond just the high deductible health plans? And unfortunately, with the high deductible, the people who probably need them the most aren't funding them. And employers are putting in amounts on the front end for some, but if it's an individual and there's some sort of subsidy or whatever, even if they're moderate income, if without a funding mechanism, and it's kind of hard. So I'm not sure that they're, I think the people that use them and fully fund them are the people who probably have the means to.
I agree. I think it's fair to me that, we've settled on just two different camps in uninsured, right? There's the uninsured that are uninsured by choice, and then there's the uninsured that are uninsured by default. They can't afford it. I don't see how HSAs are going to do anything for the uninsured by default. And so if we're really just trying to find, I mean, maybe that's where the big political black marker is the liberal camp is trying to help the uninsured by default, and the conservative camp is saying, well, let's design something that encourages or entices the uninsured by choice. I don't know. But I think there's two different answers. There's two different. Yes, HSA use would get more people that are uninsured by choice to perhaps want to buy a policy, but I don't know if that's.
So I agree. I agree with that. I'm going to build on that a little bit. I think there's the two corollaries to that. Or do you believe that the uninsured by not by choice are smart enough, quote unquote, to understand an HSA and use it appropriately, right? So how you fund their insurance becomes the question. And you could argue that one of the plans could be that the government would, instead of giving a subsidy for the insurance, you'd put those funds into that HSA, right, and teach people how to use it and be educated consumers. But I think back to the tactics of the operational exercise or scenario planning, we at least, we have a fair amount of HSA work. So we feel like we have that tool in our toolbox. Mm-hmm. And we do it with a national vendor, and therefore, if, and it's one of our HPA sponsors. So I think, if you have that tool in your toolbox, depending on how this plays out, you're ready to sort of position that the right way. Because I think if it gets done at a federal level, they're going to look to some, the first wave is going to be with the HSA providers that can do it at a national level, right? So to have that tool in our toolbox, it's just important to have, and you can sort of let the scenario play out and say, do we have to get this? If we don't have it live now, when do you have to pull that trigger to get that in process?
So this is questionable. Another issue that has come up is millennials. So,
I just have a question on HSAs. Something just hit me that, we try to keep the people in that are young and healthy, aren't really using much benefits or anything in a year, and we want them into the risk pool because it offsets everybody who's older and sicker. And we wait for the individual to put money in the HSA or for the employer to put it. Has any insurer looked at if somebody's, stays relatively healthy, they're doing the right types of things, an incentive as an insurer, you could put money, like a refund or rebate back into an HSA as long as they renew and stay with you. One, it might keep people from moving around, and secondly, it puts some money in that they're just going to end up using probably for your own providers when they need it, but it would get them used to the idea of how do they put it in. I don't know if that's legal to do it or not, but it would be kind of an interesting approach to have the insurer do that as a retention strategy.
We've actually talked about that, not quite the same way, but similar to sort of multi-year strategy. How do you get that consumer loyalty, and are there ways for you to build a rebate on the premium that goes into the HSA or something like that, that you know, the more years you're with us, the more we give some kind of benefit. It's kind of a lot of indecision around that and as to whether how that plays out, I think, with the refinement. So.
It's sort of like you don't get the right MLR in aggregate, you use the right
Yeah.
This one would be if you don't hit certain things as individuals, so individual.
Right. I think the other thing, though, that you made a comment that I just wanted to, that's why I grabbed the mic again. The idea that the healthies are who you want in the individual market is sort of shifting. At least in our book and the way our thing looks. We started 3 years ago with looking at a pretty adverse selection book, part of our book of business in the individual exchange, and that we really were afraid that we weren't going to get the risk adjusters on. First year, you wait 3 years, you get most of it back, but not all of it. Second year, we got almost break even. Third year, we're actually now talking about maybe we want more of those sick chronic patients because that's where the risk adjusters maybe have overshot. So I think the constant look at how that looks is important. And I think we saw some of the big players think they had big success by grabbing a lot of the healthies, and then they had big payouts that they had to make, and that's why some of them had massive losses. So I think it's not as clear in the individual exchange as the way the waves are moving than perhaps some of our other markets that are more mature.
It's an important point. Some of the carriers that got forced to exit after the first year is because their mix was too young and healthy. Yeah, they had, all the zero deductible people that in bronze plans. Yeah,
right. And if you go back, they were the ones claiming victory year one.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, they were thumbs up. We're doing great
until
second year, and then all of a sudden, you watch their public announcements, and well, maybe not so great last year. And
so I put down on here sophistication and risk adjustment, right? I think in scenario one, around sort of the risk adjust. Well, I guess the AHCA doesn't really disrupt the risk adjustment mechanism. So in the first two scenarios, it's a fair point that you need a sophisticated approach to understanding the trade-off, right? In the other two, you could almost see a race to who can get the most millennials, right? The thing that I am wondering about is if there will be new, different products that appeal more to millennials, that are an integrated delivery and insurance strategy that pulls them out of the traditional risk pool altogether, right? And I could see that happening in any of these scenarios. I mean, I could see that happening if you as urgent care centers get more hip or whatever. Telemedicine. I mean, we see models of this. These aren't fancy, like fantasy. We see them now of millennial-oriented delivery mechanisms that have some kind of catastrophic something associated with it, and that rely on the experience. They're in the community, telemedicine-oriented, or whatever. If those scaled, it could significantly pull millennials out of the traditional insurance risk pool. So that would be very disruptive to the market. Yeah.
For young people, I think that I don't think there's ever been anything that's been attractive. When I was in my early 20s, there was nothing that was attractive about purchasing insurance. And I don't think they're by doing the same thing, just saying, if you get sick, put money here or pay a premium there so that if you get sick, then it'll pay for that. That choice always comes down to, well, that's great, but I also have a motorcycle payment or my apartment or this or that, and my motorcycle's way cooler. So if there isn't something that addresses the point in their lives that they are, think, for example, we have two funding mechanisms for healthcare and retirement in Social Security and Medicare. So if understanding where people are in the point in their life that some of those dollars could be diverted, that could be diverted and set aside as an HSA type of alternative for you that could then fund telemedicine, have a catastrophic coverage policy, things like that, that could cooperate with your auto insurance, something that changes, that turns the world of insurance on its ear a bit, is the only thing, in my estimation, that can make something that would be attractive to those folks and fund it at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, my sense, because you can't make them not young and not feel invincible and well.
Right. So it's a fair point that there could be a lot of pressure on this. I would say that, you know, the amount of urgent care availability has changed a lot in the last 5 years, right? And if that continues to increase, a young person could reasonably say, if I ever need a doctor, I just need to pay $50 and go down the street. The pressure on them to get insurance is different than it was when I was young, when I felt tremendous pressure to get insurance because I'd have to go to a traditional doctor setting, right? So,
I mean, that's what it's all about, is getting connected.
But to address this, many payers are increasing their access to the types of services that millennials might want, right? So one could say that some action here is sophistication on risk adjustment, but also understanding or updating models that could engage keeping young people in the system. Is that fair?
Keeping them in it, it's more getting them
to... Or drawing. Right? Drawing young people. So I'm going back also to thinking about Porter's rules. I could see two things. One thing I could think of this is that an organization that's only in the individual market or largely is kind of a little bit concerned right now. Many of the co-ops are concerned. So you could see make an argument for market diversification of not having all your eggs in one basket. You also could see an argument for getting really good at one thing, that there's some market, either a benefit design or a network design or a set of constituents. Perhaps it's getting to be really good at understanding and treating the multi-generations of the Chinese American community or whatever it is that you're better at than everybody else. So there's sort of this yin and the yang thing. One idea could be diversify to make sure you've got something to withstand jolts, but then also really specialize, do something better than everybody else. Thoughts on that? I'm just going to write them down because I heard like ringing endorsement. I think the specialization thing is something that we started to see people look at when it came to the individual markets and the exchanges and risk adjustment, saying maybe I could just be better than everyone else at serving asthma. People with asthma, and then I can beat the risk adjustment on that, right? So we started to see some targeted membership activity on the individual market, and you could see that escalating. So this idea of specializing is something that, like specializing in certain demographics or certain types of people, isn't something that has been as broad in health insurance. We've been sort of best things for all people. So that's a little bit new. All right, any other actions we take across all? Well,
I'd say lower cost structure.
Yeah.
Still, regardless of the scenario, you need to compete on affordability. And in one scenario, you're going to have to downsize.
Lower cost products. I'm going to say another thing. Lower cost structure. Got it. Sorry. So. Admin. All right. I'm gonna throw another thing out there. I have worked with many organizations who proudly, with like complete just pride, say we don't have time for strategy. We are too busy. We are dealing with the crises that are coming to us, and we don't have time for that foofiness. And the way they're handling the uncertainty in the market is what I do the night forward. The article, forwarding each other articles at night. but without taking the time to sit down as a leadership team and discuss the articles together, discuss these things together and apply them to their own business, right? So I have met with different people on the leadership team of an organization and found that the CFO, the COO, and the CEO have completely different views of what's happening in the environment, and they don't have, and they're all spinning plates, so they haven't come down together and said, these are the four things that could happen, and this is what we would do in each of them. And so I'm going to suggest, because this is my thing, that in times of uncertainty, it becomes mission critical for organizations to find a way to very efficiently keep the executive team on board and marching together, and then communicating that to the rest of the company. I know that when Trump was elected, many organizations were in crisis because people at all levels of the organization were almost panicked about what it meant for their jobs, their markets, their consumers, their providers, or whatever, right? So in that sense, I'm going to suggest that it's more important than ever, because I also think a lot of time is wasted by all of these individual executives feeling personally pressured of how do I keep up with it all myself, right? And everyone's feeling guilty that they haven't read all the newsletters that are coming. They haven't read everything that the lobbyist has sent out, right? And so everyone's feeling kind of permanently bad and underprocessed. That is a huge weight on people's shoulders. So I actually have a suggestion on what you can do about that. So I'll go back to my suggestion. This is a long-term approach. It's sort of, we have a solution for this because I'm, that Spring Street Exchange does, but you don't even need to listen to us. Have a monthly workshop where you have a commonly informed view across leadership. So someone in your organization meets once a month and says, everything that happened since last time we met, this is what it covers, and consolidates inputs from various sources. Whatever resources you guys use, if you employ a lobbying organization, if you have relationships from advisors, all that kind of stuff, all that stuff gets filtered in one place at one time, right? And it minimizes these articles flying around, and it keeps it top of mind, and then you apply it to your business, right? So all of your execs know that once a month, there's going to be a time where I'm going to get updated on everything I need to know, and we're going to figure out what it means for us today, right? You don't have to revisit your scenarios quite as often. You know, maybe revisit the scenarios a couple times a year now, right? But if you have this kind of monthly meeting, it will, I think it could, you know, one of the things that I see the most with people is just the anxiety and the inability to keep up. And they don't want another email with another set of things to read in order to do that, right? They need to have a place where it's off their shoulders, they just show up. So anyway, that's my suggestion. We do this for people if anyone wants to do it with us, but I don't want to be all salesy about that. So let's do... in order to stabilize an uncertainty, what we want to do is take this uncertainty and lasso it so it's just no big problem. Because what we've learned is that uncertainty is always happening. We had the ACA, we had the AACA, we had this election. It's not like suddenly things are going to start stabilizing, right? So we got to get to the point where we're thinking uncertainty, schmuncertainty, right? So we want to monitor external trends, see what's happening outside of us, marinate, discuss, and apply. Marinate and discuss and apply. This is the monthly meeting I'm suggesting. I know some organizations that are now doing this every other week. And, you know, you can adjust the frequency depending on what's happening. And then maintain an evolving strategic plan. I think many organizations have already shifted away from the 3-year strategic plan or an annually updated strategic plan. Many are moving to a much more dynamic methodology of strategic planning. But maintaining a schedule of knowing when you're going to revisit it. Monitoring your own performance, going back to what Porter said around your own alignment, what are we doing? Is what we're doing aligning with our strategic plan and bringing data to all those sessions? Sort of assessing the alignment between what you're doing and what's happening, and then rinse and refine. And what I mean by that is just continually kind of updating the information, refining it, and bringing it back again. So this is stabilizing around uncertainty, and hopefully it will bring us to the place where we can say, uncertainty, schmuncertainty, because we've got to learn to live with this in a way that doesn't just undo us all, right? The tension that we carry is a burden on all of us, our teams. So this is our little graphic that summarizes everything we learned today. We rolled the dice to manage. We turned uncertainty to something we tried to manage with probabilities. We applied Porter for a larger framework. We discussed how we maybe not want to end up with all the eggs in one basket. So I think that brings us to our conclusion.
Thank you.
Yeah?